Hello, this is Alberto Grignolo. I am Deputy Editor of DIA Global Forum, and we are here at the DIA 2015 Annual Meeting in Washington, D.C., speaking with Leslie Sam, Director of Global Quality Systems at Eli Lilly and Company, and with Anne Meeker O'Connell, Head of Risk Management and External Engagement at Johnson & Johnson. Leslie and Anne have been overseeing Track 11, which is focused on innovative approaches to ensuring quality in clinical trials and compliance to good clinical practice at this annual meeting, and they are in a position to tell us about what are the key themes in this track at this annual meeting, which is very heavily attended. And I have a question for both of them, and the question is, in this industry where data are king, how does one quantify the quality of a clinical trial? Leslie, perhaps you could start.
Right. Firstly, I would just like to say thank you for the invitation to share perspective on these really important and I think relevant topics. So the quantification of quality in a clinical trial is really predicated on the thought that you are actually collecting data to measure improvement. And that data or those measurements will really be determined by what is felt to be critical to that organization. So, for example, right the first time, but it's maybe not 100% right. Maybe there's degrees while you're focusing on those errors that matter that will lead you to good decision-making with reliable data.
Thank you. And do you have a perspective on this question?
Yeah, I think it's always been a challenge to talk about quantifying quality when we talk about clinical trials. I used to get this question a lot when I was still at the FDA of exactly just tell me a percentage of how many data points I need to be accurate. And I think that's a little bit far afield from what we need to be focusing on. It's not that you have 80% or 85%. I think it's exactly what Leslie was referring to, that for each individual trial, you're going to understand what's critical to quality and understand how much tolerance you have for errors and those critical variables. And that may differ from trial to trial. So I think it's always been, whether on the FDA side or industry side, hard-pressed to come up with an exact number for, you know, what's good enough, because I think it's less about kind of, we certainly know you don't have to have a perfect error-free data set. But I think the tolerance for error is going to really differ based on the type of trial design you have. And so you have to take into account those individual factors. And I think we heard in a session earlier today from Annabella Markel at EMA that it really is up to each sponsor company to really think about their individual trial and set those thresholds based on the design, based on kind of their experience.
Based on what you are hearing at the various sessions from the various experts, are we entering firmly into an era divided into two pieces, if you will, errors that matter and errors that matter less, or not at all? Are we at that point yet, or not quite?
I think we're getting there, because I think one of the sessions we had yesterday was from the Clinical Trials Transformation Initiative, their Clinical Quality by Design project, and I think that's where the phrase errors that matter occurred. I'm actually involved in that CTTI project, and I blame my colleague Martin Landry from Oxford for being the originator of that phrase. But I think it's something that really has entered the vernacular for clinical trials. It makes sense to people who aren't risk management devotees and people who aren't fans of jargon. It kind of resonates. And so I think that ability to really distill down to what matters most to the credibility of data and to the protection of patients is something that pretty much everyone around a table, regardless of their function, can kind of center on, and it really can facilitate a good dialogue. And it makes sense to our regulators, too, that there are things that matter to their decision-making about approval.
I don't know if you... What the whole paradigm presents is an opportunity to consider those errors, those issues that matter before any work gets started, before any planning is discussed, but to really kind of have firm agreement where, if and when we encounter an error, an issue, where are we going to devote our time, energy, and resources, and perhaps eliminate that error. So it's really kind of shifting the paradigm unknowingly, maybe by design, to a quality by design, but without using all the vernacular. Sometimes I just think that trips people up, but they really are doing it. You know, but with risk-based monitoring, for example, that really is kind of pushing people towards that direction to think about what are those issues or those deviations, those situations that we are likely to incur, and where do we want our monitors to spend the time to try to tease out those issues, or where do we want our data experts, our data reviewers to focus their time. But it's all kind of predicated on begin with the end in mind, and let's do that upfront planning to think about what issues are we likely to encounter and to prioritize those.
And I would add probably the one thing is that it's also the phrase errors that matter also allows people to say to whom. Mm-hmm. And so I think it prompts an inquiry not just into a sponsor's perspective or a regulator's perspective. What are the things that may matter most to a patient? So it facilitates a broad inclusion of parties. And I totally agree with Leslie. It's prospectively when you're designing a trial so that you're able to say, this is an error that matters most, and we've considered the diversity of perspectives of people who are engaged in being carrying out the trial, planning the trial, being involved as a participant, and we can plan prospectively on how to prevent those and also how to monitor for them.
Mm-hmm. And since you mentioned patients, I'm moved to ask, are there errors that matters to patients but might not matter to regulators and vice versa? And if so, does that cause a problem for a sponsor?
I'm hard pressed to think of a specific one that would matter to patients but not to regulators. And I'll just speak from prior experience that a lot of our attention was really focused on protection of participants. I think there may be, we've had within the City Quality by Design project patient advocates or patients participating in every workshop. And I think that in many cases they're aligned with kind mm-hmm. of the health authority's view, and what I think has been most interesting is that it's expanded kind of the focus of let's involve patients to give us advice on recruitment. Like later in the game when we're having trouble recruiting, let's talk to the patient advocates and really emphasize they have a much more meaningful, valuable role in trial design. What mm-hmm. aspects, which endpoints, which outcomes matter most to me as a patient? And so I think that's probably where they've added value.
All right. Leslie, you have a point of view on this?
I absolutely agree that, you know, shifting the paradigm from what the sponsor needs, from the regulator needs, to more perspective on what the patient needs is going to be critical, because our patients, our consumers, our customers, they're becoming more and more savvy. They're asking questions we didn't even know to ask, you know. So they're going to be searching through the data to see, hey, what's behind the reputation of this drug manufacturer. So I want to be able to pass the red face test as everyone else does and not put them in a position where they have to question the quality of the research where they can focus on getting well.
I just heard someone, a patient advocate, in a session this afternoon, this is Tuesday, June 16th, issue a call to action to everybody to include the patient voice in every step mm-hmm. of the drug development process. Okay. And this lady made this call to action basically saying, if you involve a patient in every single step of the development process, we will all be better off. What do you think of that call to action?
I think it's the right thing to do and long overdue. I mean, yeah. You know, we all ourselves are patients of some sort, or our parents are, or our family members, and I want them to be comfortable, be confident enough to know that the research that was done to get them their medication involved someone else who shared their experience, has had a family member in their experience, so that they feel confident that the right thing is being done to them, for them, with them, by their healthcare provider.
And as a former regulator, and refresh our memory as to what your role was at FDA, but as a former regulator, how do you see the voice of the patient being integrated into the entire drug development process?
You know, so at FDA, I left as the division director of the Division of Good Clinical Practice Compliance in CDER's Office of Scientific Investigation. And so I think where we were focused at the time was really getting the patient voice in trial design and also kind of through, you know, there's a lot of effort and attention now on getting results to patients, whether it's summary results, and I know there are a lot of companies that are actively working on getting individual patients their results. I think Pfizer has their Blue Button initiative. A lot of other companies are looking at really respecting the patient's participation. I know it's a priority for FDA now. I just recently was at a Medical Device Innovation Consortium meeting where Rob Califf, who is now the deputy commissioner, would emphasize that he just exactly what you said, that really leveraging patient input at all stages of development. So I think I see that, you know, FDA has been focused on it. I see that being continued.
Thank you. Let me move to another question relating to quality issues, of course, but particularly quality issues that are discovered after the fact. And what have you heard at this annual meeting in the various sessions on quality? What current or emerging tools might help detect and prevent quality issues before they impact a clinical trial in a negative way? Mm-hmm. Leslie?
You know, we're always going to have issues in clinical trials. You can't prevent them all. You can't even predict them all. But I think setting up an a framework or a paradigm that will position the organization to understand those issues they might be likely to encounter, and then to understand what types of actions they expect to be taken, whether it's to just correct it and learn from that experience, but the important thing is to communicate, or maybe in some instances to go the CAPA route, you know, where the full-blown investigation impact analysis. But kind of key to all of this is to learn from those experiences and position your organization or those quality components in business to share that information so that that mistake or that error isn't repeated again. Issues will happen, but I think through what we talked about earlier is that the quality by design, the risk-based approach, understanding what could possibly happen, that's the nirvana. If we can operationalize that consistently, and of course, it goes without saying, it's all predicated on knowledge management, right? You don't want to have to rely on someone and their remembrance of what the situation was, and maybe it's not through documentation, but maybe it's through a system or some other mechanism to make sure that that experience is shared. And when there is a serious situation or a serious issue, that there are proper channels to escalate that, and you know, so that important decisions can be made with reliable, valid data.
And how might technology help detect these problems and mitigate their effect before a trial goes horribly wrong?
I think technology can be a support, but I think what we've focused on in the sessions that I've been in so far in our track has really been that it's about first the people and the processes. So particularly with risk management, because I think if we're going to move from, we've gotten good at identifying issues and responding to them, we've really, and leveraging what we can learn from things that have happened, but we really need to, and I think we hear very strong encouragement, was just in the session with both FDA and EMA, encouraging really proactive approaches. So it's not enough to get better at responding when things do happen, it's about preventing things from happening. So it's really moving activities into the planning stage. And part of that is, in an organization, being able to change your processes and perhaps build competencies and people for risk management. So I think whether you're looking at ICH Q9 and transitioning that from a manufacturing focus, or ISO 31000, which is a risk management standard that talks about risks in a way that I think we talked a little bit about lexicon earlier, the errors that matter, really resonating with people more than some of the jargon of risk management. In the same way, ISO 31000 defines risk as the effect of uncertainty on objectives. So that actually is something that it really makes a difference. So if I, in a quality compliance role, go talk to my business partners and say, hi, I'm from compliance, I'd like to talk to you about your risks, that's not exactly something that people are like, great, I look forward to that. But if I go talk to them and say, I want to understand more about the objectives that are important to you, and where do you see uncertainty and being able to kind of achieve them? What has to go right and what could possibly go wrong that would really severely impact that? Then you can get to the identification of risks, a kind of mature discussion of how to address them. And so I think you get to that preventative state. I think to the original question about technology, once you have that kind of core risk management competency or awareness and the processes in place, then I think technology can be incredibly supportive. But I'm always a fan of figure out what your process is and let that drive the technology you need rather than going to pick a technology and then having that drive what your process looks like.
Do you both feel that the quality function is being seen more like a partner today than as, say, the enemy?
I think as our quality organizations become more technically deep in the quality expectations, in addition to the business expectations, it's the perfect storm, right? It's all sunshine.
Do you want me to jump in?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead and circle back.
I think in many cases they are, particularly when you have, as you're moving to more the quality of a design, the quality risk management, and you have people engaging in discussions really focused on what's critical, how do we prevent things, that allows establishment of relationships, and it's that personal interaction. So when something happens, I know who to call. Yeah. And so, right. there's a part of a relationship building aspect.
And the other partners,
business partners. And the other thing is, I think that a lot of the activities and the discussions we've been hearing throughout our track are focusing on really de-emphasizing the big Q, that there's a quality department that comes and enforces, and more a small Q, that quality is part of everyone's roles, everybody's responsibilities. And I think this you see reflected, we had a session on the Transcelerate Clinical Quality Management System, and a big part of the foundations for this conceptual, this clinical QMS conceptual framework that's being developed is culture. It came out also during multiple other sessions that culture is important, that people feel, regardless of where they are in the organization, they know where their responsibility for quality, but they also feel empowered to drive quality. So if there's an issue, they don't fear escalating it, but on the flip side, they're not over-escalating, so you end up with a lot of things escalated and can't find the signal amidst the noise.
Indeed. Leslie, a thought around this?
So, one of the things that I've observed is while the business is focused on those historically key performance indicators, project management type of concepts, timeline, budget, scope, and then sometimes quality is added on, sometimes not, but business isn't typically able to tangibly speak to what does quality mean. And so while they're focused on, moving that protocol, that study on forward, they have changes, right? So they have protocol amendments, change the informed consent, but by working closely with the quality organization, they're then in a better position to understand the cost of quality, so that they're just focused on moving the study on, getting the project done, but while quality then can focus on helping them to understand you got your result, but what was the cost? And it's not just dollars, right?
So you mean it's the cost of poor quality?
Yes. What was the cost of that rework, right? And that missed opportunity to get it right the first time.
And a delay to patients,
right, exactly,
as a result.
Exactly.
Right. Well, we couldn't possibly part ways without raising the topic of risk-based monitoring. What are you hearing about risk-based monitoring at this annual meeting in the various sessions? What's the update? Is it working? Is it not working?
Oh, you're pointing it to me. Yeah, sure.
And would you like to take that one?
Sure. Okay. I always get the questions about risk-based monitoring because I was involved in writing the guidance at FDA.
But, no good deed goes unpunished.
I know. Yeah? But I actually think, we're seeing a clear progression from kind of understanding the concepts to people have gone through their pilots and are now really starting to think about how do we operationalize this in a sustainable manner. So I think Transcelerate has done significant work in this area and putting forth their kind of paper and and continuing to provide insights into how you might go about meaningfully implementing risk-based monitoring within an organization. I think it's still an area where what I've seen is across regions some differences in uptake. I think it's been, and some of it is just regional differences.
Where is it taken up and where is it less taken up?
I think in the U.S. there's been a lot of focus on it from FDA in the past 4 years that people are slowly kind of have adapted their organizational structures and are working towards it. But I just came back from Japan, and I think had a lot of discussions there because people are very interested in it and very seeking to really implement it. But it's
industry or regulators?
Both.
Hmm.
PMDA is very focused on the revision of ICH-E6 and supporting its implementation, and industry is as well. But I think for them, it was a little bit of a surprise to me that they have a concept of over quality, and I said, "What's over quality?" And so it's basically a lot of the focus has been traditionally on quality control, verification of each data point. So it's much more of a shift for them to move to a model of risk-based monitoring. There's a definite energy about it. So, but I think it's been, I think we're well down the curve.
Right. I worked in Japan for 2 years, and I did see the concept of overquality applied every day, equated to perfection, essentially. And it's a different way of looking at quality, and you pointed out, I think, something I've observed as well. Leslie, please.
I'm just going to add that, and judging by the volume of abstracts that we received for this year's DIA meeting, I think it's well on its way. And much more so as people were looking for the opportunity to share their experience. And it wasn't just from big pharma. It was from small sites and what their experience is to be on the back end of it, you know, the recipient of that risk-based monitoring. We had all different sizes of companies and stakeholder types who were really interested in sharing that their experience with risk-based monitoring. There wasn't so much theory in, you know, what it should be. It was more of, here's how we're doing it. You know, and looking for affirmation from their peers that, you know, are we doing it right?
Is anybody reporting any metrics on whether risk-based monitoring has impacted the quality of clinical trials one way or the other, improving it or lessening it?
I haven't attended any sessions with that, but I know it's something that Transcelerate has been actively publishing on and looking at for the pilots that they've been doing in aggregate. They have some key metrics that they're following. How many protocol deviations? They're looking at critical audit observations and have found that that it actually is, they're seeing improvements with the pilots. They look at it in aggregate across quarters. I know that, so I think there are people talking about it. I think what people are waiting for is that we've had a major submission to an agency that's been based on this approach, and we didn't have any issues, or it sailed through. But I do think there are people who are looking at it, particularly because you want to be able to show that it's effective, and you want to be able to show, you know, there are a varying range of perspectives within an organization, from people who are highly supportive to people who are supportive but have that edge of concern that this is something different, this might impact my application or our company. And so it's, I think that data is really important to show that, and you know, I would say we've looked at it personally kind of in terms of our audits, and we're not seeing any differences between trials that are under our risk-based paradigm that we've moved to what we saw previously. So that's actually very kind of, it makes people comfortable.
What measures do your companies or others in the industry look at when evaluating whether risk-based monitoring is beneficial or harmful? Is it based on historical controls? You look at trials that were previously done with traditional monitoring versus a trial today that's done using risk-based monitoring, or are companies running trials in parallel using risk-based monitoring in trial A and not in trial B? How is this being done? Are both approaches adopted or not?
I think that both approaches are being done. I know that from, I mentioned the metrics that Transcelerate is following. What they've done is looked at historical averages from previous trials, so historical compared to now. But I do know of companies that have looked at, let's run this trial is risk-based monitoring, this one isn't, or ones that are roughly similar, or ones where they started out traditional and shifted to a risk-based approach to compare, you know, whether there were changes. So I think people are definitely looking at it. And I think we'll have those data soon that will help kind of build confidence. I think what I see as a challenge now is we have risk-based monitoring, we have the city quality of a design, and we have Transcelerate working on a clinical QMS conceptual framework. It's helping people see how all of those complement each other but are different. And that was part of discussions we had yesterday during one of the sessions, just clarifying, particularly with a FDA, kind of their perspective on how they fit together. And I think it aligns well with what many of us have been thinking, that kind of a quality management system is your holistic structure to provide for support quality across the spectrum of activities. Quality by design is another umbrella focused on a particular trial, and risk-based monitoring is one aspect of, it's one way in which the things you decide are critical to quality and you want to monitor risks, you can Mm-hmm. Risk-based monitoring is one way of reviewing them. So I think that's going to be, to me, the next step is we have all of these amazing kind of innovations in the quality mm-hmm. realm, really kind of pushing people to think a little bit differently, but we'll have to help them make sense of how they fit together.
Mm-hmm. Leslie, what have you heard in closing about the intersection between risk-based monitoring and technology? Has technology helped risk-based monitoring come of age? Has it been an essential factor in risk-based monitoring coming of age? Could it have been done without technology?
I think technology will be key because that could quickly become a resource drain, because one of the key components of a risk-based monitoring approach is that more centralized, remote data monitoring review. And just imagine, trying to do that with maybe some of the limited technologies that maybe some of the smaller companies, even larger companies have. So the technology piece is really going to be key, and I believe there's work ongoing to understand what are the specs, what do you have to have an effective IT system to support risk-based monitoring.
And as I asked you about technology, I realized I wasn't specific as to what types of technology are we talking about. Is it electronic data capture? Is it something else? In your mind, what is the technology that's relevant here?
I mean, I think there are an array of different technologies. I think EDC certainly facilitates the central monitoring that is advocated by FDA in particular in their guidance, because to be able to really look for patterns or look for trends, you need to have the data available fairly rapidly and fairly quickly. And somebody commented in one of the sessions in our track, kind of reminiscing about the days 20 years ago when it took 8 weeks to get data in from a site in the old carbon copy case report form. So I think that definitely is supportive. I also think there's, as we move towards being more predictive, a need for kind of software to help with analysis of big data. So looking across not just maybe a single trial, but across trials to look for what are the things we want to capture that may help us in the future predict the potential for issues. And I think there's, particularly when you get into things like, can we do statistical monitoring and look for patterns that may be suggestive of fraud? I've been in discussions where people were talking about what's done in other industries, say the credit card industry, where they're, and so I don't think we have that now, but I think as we get there, particularly as we have data available, I won't say instantaneously, but much more in real time, I think that becomes more feasible.
Thank you both. Our time is up. I'd like to thank our guests today, Leslie Sand, Director of Global Quality Systems at Eli Lilly and Company, and Anne Meeker O'Connell, Head of Risk Management and External Engagement at Johnson & Johnson. Thank you both for being with us today. For the AA Global Forum, this is Alberto Grignolo.